From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We're going to celebrate President's Day today by playing back three interviews from our archives. We'll hear about Andrew Johnson, who was thrust into the nation's highest office after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. We'll also listen to my interview with John Dean, who worked in Richard Nixon's White House as legal counsel. He joined us a few years ago to discuss his book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. But first, we'll learn about the early days in John F. Kennedy's presidency. Presidential historian Robert Dalek talks about the people Kennedy chose for his cabinet and the effect this had on his tenure as president. That's all ahead here on WHYY. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us on this President's Day. We're going to revisit three interviews about presidents from Radio Times past, and we begin with John F. Kennedy. Presidential historian Robert Dalek first wrote about Kennedy in An Unfinished Life, about underreported medical conditions that plagued the late president. That was followed by Camelot's Court inside Kennedy's White House. We discuss Kennedy's early years serving as commander-in-chief and some of the people he surrounded himself with. Let's take a listen. You describe, and I'm sure it's true for every president, and it was certainly true for Kennedy, which is that transition from a grueling campaign, and here you are, you know, you win the office, you win the, you know, you become the president of the United States, and this kind of, what are we going to do now?
Right.
And everyone is exhausted on top of that.
Exactly. And, you know, he kind of withdrew instantly after the campaign, and he complained to his father and said, this one wants that, that one wants this, and joked with him and said, listen, Jack, they haven't counted all the ballots yet in Cook County. If you don't want to take the office, you don't have to do it, you see. So,
well, there was a ruthlessness in this family, was
Was there ever. Yes.
But I'm assuming every president, you know, picks a cabinet with the idea that they will give the best advice or this will be my sounding board.
Right.
Was that true for Kennedy?
Yeah. But you see, he picked people. It was partly the consequence of the very close election. He only won by 118,000 votes. And he was concerned to create a kind of bipartisan administration, a national government, if you will. And so he keeps J. Edgar Hoover on as head of the FBI, another conservative, Alan Dulles, as the director of the CIA. And he appoints Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who was a moderate Republican. He didn't know him, never met him, but had a fabulous reputation as the president of the Ford Motor Company and a brilliant young administrative director.
But no Pentagon background
experience. No, none at all. And McNamara said to him, I don't know anything about administering the Defense Department. Kennedy said, I don't know anything about running the presidency. He said, but, you know, we'll both do it. And then, of course, he appointed Dean Rusk, who was a very passive sort of a character, and that's what Kennedy wanted. Of course, he wanted to control foreign affairs. Mm. He had the people surrounding him. The Secretary of the Treasury was Eisenhower's Treasury Secretary, C. Douglas Dillon. He didn't know him. The only one he really knew was, of course, his brother, Robert,
sure,
who he made attorney general. And somebody said to him, you know, you're going to get yourself into political difficulties with this kind of nepotism. He said, look, I need someone I can put my feet up with and talk to candidly. And that's the role that Bobby played. More than that, I have a chapter in the book called Robert Kennedy, Advisor in Chief. He didn't have a chief of staff, Kennedy, but Bobby Kennedy was essentially the chief of staff.
And he also sounds like he played the role of the enforcer on top of that.
Without question.
I mean, he was more willing to be direct and overt,
right,
about
absolutely
throwing his weight around.
And you know, Marty, we will never have the many, many conversations I'm convinced they had behind closed doors that were not recorded, that were not put down on paper. And people would say, they'd come into a meeting with Bobby and the president and several other people, cabinet officers, whoever might have been CIA, defense, Pentagon officials. And Bobby would drop the dime on somebody or other. And Jack would sit there with a slight smile on his face. And the supposition was they knew what was going to be said. And the president wouldn't say it. He didn't want to come down on one side or the other. But Bobby was sort of reflecting what he was thinking.
The kind of good cop, bad cop approach to foreign policy in many instances. And we're almost up on a break here, but it sounds like Bobby Kennedy's experience in Congress sort of prepared him for being the enforcer.
Yeah. Well, but Bobby's temperament was more like his father, Joe's. And he was a he was a tough guy, and he played hardball, and he thought and understood that politics was hardball. Of course, he and Lyndon Johnson were at each other's throats, and Johnson is vice president, and Bobby is attorney general, and then, oh goodness, they were really at it.
So, I mean, from your perspective, you see Kennedy as while he hired these people to be his advisors. He also was reluctant to take their advice.
Yeah, he became skeptical. He valued Bob McNamara, I think, most of all, after Bobby, of the people in his cabinet. And that's because McNamara gave him very sound advice during the missile crisis. McNamara was one of the principal architects and supporters of the idea that you try diplomacy first and resisted the military pressure to use force.
Meanwhile, while all this is going, things are heating up in Vietnam. And, of course, there are theories about whether Kennedy would have gotten us into Vietnam the way Johnson did, whether he would have whether he would have stood on the sidelines or figured out how to get out or use diplomacy or whatever. What is your analysis of that?
Well, my analysis of it is that we'll never know exactly what Kennedy would have done. We'll never know. Right. And because he himself was unsure. But I think there was tremendous reluctance on his part to expand the war and turn it into strictly or principally an American enterprise. He didn't want to send in ground troops. Now, there was a lot of pressure on him, particularly from Walt Rostow, who later became Lyndon Johnson's national security advisor. And Rostow was a fierce hawk. He wanted to bomb Hanoi and Haiphong as early as 61, 62. He wanted to talk about sending in those ground troops. And there was a split in the administration between those who were pressing him to think about putting in ground forces. Now, the compromise Kennedy made was to increase the number of military advisors from roughly 600 to something like 16,700. So that was a substantial expansion. But he wanted to keep this as low-key as possible, and he ran into a lot of conflict with the press, and particularly with David Halberstam, who was the New York Times bureau chief in Saigon. And Kennedy kept saying, because what's so interesting, of course, is that Halberstam later became someone who you saw as a fierce critic of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
In fact,
Best and the Brightest is one of his books.
That's right.
Yeah.
But early on, he wrote a book about the morass, the way in which we were not winning in Vietnam. And he was pressing for the idea that we needed to win. We shouldn't lose in Vietnam. So Kennedy was very skeptical of him, and he tried to get him out of Vietnam, asking the publisher of the New York Times to remove him. But the publisher wouldn't do it, to his credit, you see. But there was a lot of pressure on Kennedy to escalate that conflict. Now, I don't think – we'll never know, as I say, what he would have done. But I don't think he ever would have put in the massive numbers of ground forces that Johnson put in, 545,000. George Ball, the Undersecretary of State, said to Kennedy at one point, "Mr. President, you put 200,000-300,000 American forces in there on the ground in those jungles. We'll never hear from them again." See? And Kennedy said to him, "George, you're crazy as hell." And I think, meaning, I'm never going to do that. I won't do it. He didn't want to lose Vietnam. That would have been a terrible political blow to him. But We'll never know what he would have done.
But you do write about Johnson, and I'm quoting here, upon prodding from the White House, Johnson offered unqualified advice against a substantial U.S. military effort in South Vietnam's conflict.
Yeah, Johnson went out as vice president on a trip to Southeast Asia, visited Vietnam. He came back and he made the case that the White House wanted him to make against the idea of sending troops there. Johnson privately said, I was sent out there with a stacked deck, you see. He, in essence, was the good vice president. The president wants you to do this. You've got to do it. And that's the way he treated Hubert Humphrey when he became president. Hubert, you do what I tell you to do. You are my man in court, so to speak. So Johnson had a different view, but he was reflecting, I think, what the White House wanted from him.
And they did not have the most, what shall I say, collegial relationship.
No.
Seems like they tolerated each other.
Right. And, you know, and the president understood Johnson was a huge ego and a man who felt diminished by the fact that he had been the great force in the Senate. And Johnson hoped to turn the vice presidency into something it had never been before. Indeed, Johnson wrote a memo, which he passed to Kennedy, asking for enhanced powers. And Kennedy read it. He laughed. He threw it into a drawer. See, never to be heard from again. Because what Kennedy understood was he was the younger guy, much more in Johnson's shadow as a senator, and he could not afford to be seen as running a co-presidency with Lyndon Johnson. So he had to rein Johnson in. Part of the way they did it was they sent him on these trips. So you let him go around the world. He'll be the big shot there. He'll go into Vietnam. He'll go into Cambodia. He'll go into wherever. And he sends him to Berlin when the Berlin crisis takes place. And Johnson's very reluctant to go. He's afraid he's going to be caught in the middle of a crossfire, you see. But he sends him there. Get him out of the country. Just let him sort of do his thing abroad.
Do you think, though, Kennedy ignored domestic policy, that his real interest, I mean, clearly his focus, but that his real interest was the world stage?
Oh, without question. He said, you know, politics can unseat you, but foreign policy can kill you. And civil rights is most interesting here because he was very reluctant to put a civil rights bill before the Congress. He feared that if he did that, it would undermine the three other domestic initiatives he had, which was a big tax cut, federal aid to education, and Medicare, you see. And he thought that if he could hold off on civil rights till a second term, maybe he'd get these through the Congress. But he got nowhere with it. It was a failed strategy. And then when he had this crisis in Mississippi, James Meredith, the integration of the university, and he had the big crisis in Alabama, he felt compelled finally to do something about this because he said, you know, these folks in the South, they keep saying, stay out, we'll take care of it. He said they never will. And also he understood that the Soviets, the Chinese, were beating up unmercifully on the United States as a racist society. He was struggling to win the hearts and minds, as he put it, of people in the developing world, the third world. And as long as people of color were being told America is a racist society in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, it was going to be a losing battle, he felt. And so he had to act on this, both for foreign policy reasons and for moral concerns.
That was my 2013 interview with Robert Dalek, author of Camelot's Court, Inside Kennedy's White House. When we get back from the break, we'll continue our President's Day theme show with John Dean, author of The Nixon Defense. Stay with us. Welcome back to the President's Day edition of Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We turn now to one of the most controversial presidencies in American history, that of Richard Nixon. We got some insight into Nixon and his White House when John Dean was our guest in 2013. He served as legal counsel to the White House and got an inside look into how Nixon governed and the lead up to the Watergate scandal. He discusses all of this in his book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Let's take a listen. It seems after 40 years, we should have been able to answer every single question about Nixon and Watergate, and yet questions still remain. Why is that?
One of the reasons is that nobody did dig into these tapes and find out what Nixon had actually done. He put out his defense as it occurred, and there are different phases. It evolves. He writes a little bit about what he didn't report elsewhere in his memoir. But I, you know, as somebody who was involved in all this, kept thinking, you know, what's happening behind closed doors that I don't know about? Because the White House counsel is a pretty middle-level job. I know a couple judges that say they wish they'd talked to me before they left lifetime appointments to take the job.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Sounds better on paper.
It sounds better on paper. And the job's always been pretty much the same. And you wait for the president to call you. And in this instance, I didn't talk to the president until eight months after the arrest at the Watergate. So I don't know what he knows or is doing, and that's really what I tried to figure out. I started the book because I wanted to know how somebody as savvy politically as Nixon and intelligent could botch his presidency so badly over a bungled burglary.
Now, we're talking about tapes. So these were the tapes that Nixon secretly made. So these were tapes that Nixon knew about, essentially taping conversations in his
In a number of offices. He does know about them. And one of the interesting things on the tape, you can tell at times he totally forgets that the system is voice activated. What happened is they put the system in the Oval Office. They put it in his executive office billing office. It's on a number of telephones. It's in his Camp David study. The phones in Camp David. In doing so, it's a fairly primitive system. They literally drilled holes in some of these historic desks that other presidents had used to put the microphones in there. And I happened to be somebody, when I went in, seemed to be sitting over a microphone every time I got in there.
So you were loud and clear, right?
I was loud and clear. No idea I was being recorded. I suspect it later, but that's later in the story. But anyway, only Haldeman and the president know that the system is there. And Haldeman is much more conscious of it, conspicuously so, than is Nixon. But basically, they don't think about it very often. So this is pretty candid stuff.
You worked with Nixon. As you said, you weren't as close to him as some people might have thought. But the Nixon that you hear on these tapes, how would you describe him? I mean, there's so many Nixons, it
Well,
seems.
That's what you find on the tapes. You find a different Nixon with different people. For example, with his former, often labeled hatchet man, Chuck Colson, Chuck would bring out the darkest in him, and these would be pretty ugly conversations at times. Haldeman is not far from that. No, they're very candid. They're very blunt with each other. Ehrlichman is a little higher plane. With me, he's on the highest plane. It's very interesting. I learned a lot about his perception of me in doing this, because I had no idea what he thought before I went in there and when I left the meeting. And until I tell him I'm breaking rank and I'm not going to lie for anybody, I'm at the top of his list as one of his chosen few for the next administration.
You say, based on the tapes and you've written several books about Nixon and Watergate, that he did not order the break-in at Watergate.
There's absolutely no evidence. The irony is, though, had the Watergate team under Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and the Cuban American team that went in and got arrested in the and later prosecuted for the break-in, had they not been arrested that night, their real mission that night was to go to McGovern's headquarters. And by listening to the tapes, you can hear a tape where Nixon gives an instruction to Haldeman to place a plant, P-L-A-N-T,
right,
in the McGovern headquarters. Now, that may or may not be an electronic plant, or it may or just be a secretary or a volunteer or something like that. And so Haldeman takes that instruction from Nixon and has it passed to Liddy. And Liddy is told to change from his intelligence gathering from Muskie to McGovern. So had they not been arrested at the Watergate and gone on to do what was their mission the night they were arrested, it would have been traceable right back to the President of the United States.
Wow. But there, I mean, for instance, Ehrlichman had used the plumbers to break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist office. Haldeman had thought about or even suggested breaking into the Brookings Institution.
That's Nixon.
Nixon.
On three occasions. Actually, what happened on that, I happened to be the person that interrupted it. I didn't know that the president had ordered this. A fellow that would have been called into Chuck Colson's office by the name of Jack Caulfield. And Jack came to see me after leaving Colson's office and said, Colson wants me to firebomb the Brookings Institute. I said, what? I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, the president thinks there's a copy of the so-called Pentagon Papers, the study done for Lyndon Johnson on the origins of the Vietnam War, in the Brookings. And the president wants – doesn't – he knows they won't turn them over. So he just wants somebody to go in and get them. I said, Jack, don't do anything. I flew to California where the president was with the senior staff, got a hold of Ehrlichman and told him, I said, John, this is insane. I said, you know, firebomb? If somebody dies as a result of arson, it's a capital offense in the District of Columbia. And I said, I just can't imagine doing this. He picks up the telephone, calls Colson, says, young counsel Dean is out here, Chuck. Doesn't think the Brookings plan's a very good one. Cancel it. He turns to me and said, anything else, counselor? I said, no, that'll take care of it this morning, John. And I went back to Washington. Later, Bud Krogh told me that a lot of people around the White House thought there was a lot of little old lady in me.
Oh.
And I learned later that I was specifically not told about the plumber's operation for that very reason, that they knew that wasn't the sort of thing I believed they should be doing.
But that does tell you about Nixon, the Nixon White House, the people that worked for him, that all of this seemed perfectly okay.
The big thing that I took away in putting all these pieces together day by day to watch how he responds and dealt with it all, he's somewhat passive at the beginning, doesn't want to be told too much. Then he gets curious, and Haldeman and Ehrlichman don't tell him. They don't admit what all is going on. He doesn't know about the Ellsberg break-in, for example, which is driving much of the cover-up from the White House. That doesn't mean he didn't get involved in the cover-up, because he approves along the way every single step of it, because Haldeman raises it. But it's after I come in later in March that he just jumps in with both feet, and then it becomes a cover-up of the cover-up, and he never lets go and takes full charge of it at that point.
But do you think there's a case of plausible deniability? I mean, maybe there's no way of knowing that he knew but didn't know.
Well, what you could do or what one could say is that he might have, without the taping system, have had deniability. The taping system shows he was aware of the payoffs of money very early. He's aware of the subornation, in fact, encourages the subornation of perjury of Jeb Magruder. This was all new to me. It's all new to everybody, because nobody, when I got into this project and I started cataloging these conversations to try to figure out what was there, found nobody had done so, and I at that point had to do it manually. You can do it digitally. It'd still be very time-consuming. And discovered there's something like 1,000 Watergate conversations. I realized about 600 of those conversations nobody outside the archives has likely ever heard.
Forming the basis of the book. Let me ask you about a theory about...
It's more... I rely on all 1,000. They're sort of the new core of the book. But what happened also in those 1,000, some of them have been released earlier, material had been withheld. Now, because of the passing of people, the deaths had resulted in that material no longer being considered private. So I was able to fill in gaps that even earlier people had access to the tapes couldn't get all these pieces together that, given the passage of time, I could now put those together too.
So who ordered the Watergate break-in?
It's pretty clear to me what happened is when Mitchell approves the plan at a third meeting with Liddy. There are two earlier meetings in his office. One, Mitchell literally laughed at the plan and thought it was absurd. I go back after that and report to Haldeman and tell him I think that there's something very amiss here. Magruder takes him back for a second meeting. I'm invited to that meeting, get in there late and hear them talking about the same thing and said, unfortunately, I have all this on, it's all reported on tapes today, we know. I come back in and say, listen, this isn't something should ever be talked about even in the Office of the Attorney General of the United States. I was offended by it. I wanted to get Mitchell off the hook, and I wanted to get as far away from it as possible as I could. I again now know I had originally thought I had just come to Haldeman after the second meeting, but the record shows I went after both meetings and told him this was craziness that was going on.
Why didn't he destroy the tapes? I mean, when all this began to fall apart around him.
There are two. I have conversations in the book in April. It comes up a couple times where he and Haldeman talk about the taping system and you know its quality and how it's working and the fact that it'll never be available to anybody and what have you. But in April, Nixon on two occasions instructs Haldeman to remove the system. He actually says, "I'm uncomfortable recording people," but he doesn't stop doing it. And Haldeman says, "Sure, I'll take care of it," and he never does. And I think the explanation of that is that Haldeman himself then, about that time, got so consumed by Watergate himself, he just didn't think about it. And I think Haldeman also thought he wasn't a lawyer. Thought Nixon might be able to use some of this selectively by clipping out what sounded good and making the rest disappear. So the system is never removed. Even when Al Haig comes in as White House Chief of Staff, they don't tell him about the system. And I quote Haig in there as saying, you know, even he who had almost nothing bad to say about Richard Nixon, he was a, click his heels, salute, and yes, sir, and let's get it done. He thinks it's insane that Nixon didn't have some control over this system, that it was voice activated and everything in the room that was said was recorded.
There are, of course, many rumors that have floated around about this case. And of course, one of the great mysteries is this 18 and a half minutes gap on this tape. On the dates, June 20th, 1972, many theories, much conspiracy about what was on the tape and who erased it. What are your conclusions?
Well, because of the fact that there is that mystery, I decided to do a special appendix on it, which I did. Nixon's final defense is that he knew nothing about Watergate until I came in on March 21st and told him. That isn't true. We know that isn't true. I know it's not true in countless conversations. But it first arises when the Watergate prosecutor subpoenas a conversation on June 20th, his first recorded conversation with Haldeman after the arrest. He's come back from Florida, and so they had probable cause to be logical they would be talking about Watergate. We know from Haldeman's notes they did talk about Watergate. So what were they talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no mystery. There's no mystery at all. They're talking about a cover-up because all he had to do is have any inference, implication, or indication that he's involved in a cover-up, and he blows away his own last defense. That's what happens when the so-called smoking gun tape recurs 3 days later on a Friday, the 23rd, and here clearly he's very actively telling Haldeman to use the CIA to block the FBI. That's cover-up. Well, there's lots of cover-up discussion that week when they first came back. It just happens to be that the only tape that was or conversation that was subpoenaed that they had probable cause was June 20th. So whoever did do it, the reason he did it is because it would blow away his final firewall defense It's not that there was some great secret we don't know. In fact, in the totality of things, I don't think it's going to, you know, if they ever could recover that conversation, it won't begin to shed the light that many other conversations we now have do on Nixon's behavior in this. So that's the only thing it could have been, because there's just nothing else in the range of these hundreds of conversations that would justify it being erased.
But he does, by whoever erased it, Nixon makes Rosemary Wood part of the cover-up.
Well, the other thing I found out is that Rosemary Woods, as she believed she had erased it and went to court and explained that. Well, only recently a friend of mine found one of the few engineers in this country who serviced that machine. He explained that it is humanly impossible to erase a conversation in any of the ways that Rosemary Woods explained it. So you can only draw one conclusion. It wasn't Rose that did it. It was somebody else.
Do you think it was Nixon?
He would be a very strong possibility, but he's so mechanically inept. I think I know who it is. I just haven't named the person because he's still alive.
Oh, and do you like the gates that have been attached to various political scandals or even near scandals?
You know why the gates got attached is because Bill Sapphire, who had been a Nixon speechwriter, started putting the gates on. And he did that in a very effective way to try to make Watergate less of a significant event. But if you hang this gate on just the most minor types of scandals, suddenly Watergate is no big deal. And so he succeeded at this. Yeah, the suffix has added to things that just don't deserve or come anywhere close to the conduct that was involved in Watergate. And the book also makes clear that it was more than a bungled burglary and a cover-up. And this what happens is the Post very effectively, and they're the only newspaper covering it, they meld other Nixon behavior, his efforts to influence the campaign with dirty tricks, they now today are considered under any definition of Watergate as part of Watergate. So it's so much more than just the burglary and the cover-up.
I mean, it really is about the abuse of power.
That is, it is typically defined as the abuse of power for political purposes occurring during the presidency of Richard Nixon. That's kind of a typical dictionary definition.
And Nixon really truly believed that he could keep those tapes to himself?
He really does. While this taping system ends when Alex Butterfield reveals it, it's clear, and I track some of this, and I sort of summarize that in a chronology at the end to just wrap it up, because this book is basically takes the reader inside the White House via the recordings. But it's clear he gets opinions from a very eminent lawyer who said the court can't get this. This is your material. It's yours forever, and to do as you wish with.
Even though he's president and it's in the White House,
right? Well, the Charlie Wright, who wrote this opinion, later had to eat a little crow on that ruling.
That was my 2013 interview with former White House legal counsel to Richard Nixon, John Dean, about his book, The Nixon Defense. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my interview with Annette Gordon-Reed, who wrote about the presidency of Andrew Johnson, who many consider to be one of America's worst presidents. Stay with us. Welcome back to the President's Day edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. History has been kind to Abraham Lincoln, who oversaw the most tumultuous period in this country's history. His assassination was a dark moment when the country lost an inspiring leader. Suffice it to say, that made filling his shoes a gargantuan task, one that was left to Lincoln's vice president, Andrew Johnson. History has been less kind to him. Many consider him to be one of our worst presidents, between his handling of the Reconstruction era and his racist views. Historian Annette Gordon-Reed wrote about Johnson and joined us a few years back. Is it hard to write about the worst president in America?
Oh, it's a difficult task, but he was president at such an important time that it makes up for what you think about the merits of what he did. I mean, it's a way of explaining to Americans why he's important. It was a pivotal moment in American history, and you can't ignore someone who was there at such an important moment of the country's time.
Is it fair to call him the worst president we have ever had? Because that criteria
I'm not breaking any new ground saying this. I've participated over the years in surveys. They ask historians to give a list of who the best presidents are and who are the worst presidents. And typically, he comes out in the bottom five. He's considered to be a weak president. But he followed what people consider to be the best president. Many consider to be the best president. So in some ways, it's unfair.
Did he own slaves?
Yes, he did own slaves. Not lots of slaves. That was a part of life at that time. He brought his first slave when he was a fairly young man. He just got married, a woman named Dolly, as a housekeeper, and then later on her brother. And he was not a large slaveholder. He believed in slavery up until he realized that there was no way to keep the institution after the conflict with the South. But yes, he was a slave owner.
Well, and it seemed the way you write about Andrew Johnson is that he had a particular feeling for and fondness for poor whites, perhaps poor white farmers.
Yes. Well, he saw, here's where he looked at his own situation and understood that if you, as his father and mother, had no land, had no property, and you had to work for people, that's the opposite of being independent. At that time, land meant independence because you could do your own farming. You had your own stake in society. And so he felt that, poor white people should be given land and given independence. And also he was very, very much in favor of public education because he didn't have an education, and he thought that that was important. So there's this mix of really progressive, what you call populist sentiment here, but always that problem with populism. When race comes into the picture, it's the thing that has sort of ruined every populist moment. Tom Watson, you think about it, it recurs. Once you begin to think of expanding that to include blacks, that's where he pulled back. So there are lots of things about him that you could look at it and say, this is a very progressive guy, economically progressive, but the racial aspect of it really threw him.
Mm. I'm so fascinated by the various, I would say, contradictions, even hypocrisies in Andrew Johnson's life, including the fact of his view of what secession was about. It seems like he didn't even acknowledge that secession was legal and could even go on or happen in this country.
Yes, he felt that the Southern states, the Confederate States of America, had not, in fact, left the United States, that secession was impossible. And because it was a legal impossibility, then once everything got put back together again, you just sort of picked up where you left off. Now, this was a point that Lincoln said the same thing, but he was speaking about it more abstractly because I don't want to get too technical about this, but depending upon whether or not you actually believed the Southern states had left, it had implications for separation of powers. If they had not left, the president could control Reconstruction and put everything back together again as part of the powers to quell military rebellions and to put things back in order. If they had left and they were like territories, then Congress had the authority to govern them as territories. Well, he believed that secession was illegal and they could not have left. Jeff Davis, those people, they didn't have a true government, a legitimate government. And so therefore, the president should be in control of Reconstruction and putting everything back together again. So it was a very, his whole view about secession really, one part of it that was definitely unique is that he was the only Southerner, border state Southerner person who remained in Washington, remained in office, as a senator. He was very, very loyal to the Union and to the concept of Union, which is interesting because he was a Southerner at some level. He believed in slavery up until, as I said, it became politically expedient not to, but he definitely believed in the Union. And he took his cue from his hero, Andrew Jackson, who said, the Union, it must be preserved. And he definitely stuck with that all of his life. The Union was very, very important to him.
And how did Northerners or even abolitionists view Andrew Johnson?
Well, it was sort of, they blew hot and cold on this because they loved the rhetoric and the talk about Union, preserving the United States of America. They were not overly fond once he got in office and it became clear that he did not see any place for black political rights in the South, against voting, against land reform, all of those kinds of things. Even the most conservative Republicans, a different party than we have Republicans today, exactly. Even the most conservative Republicans felt that there had to be some political transformation of the South. And once they realized that he was not for that, he was less popular. But his stance on the Union mm-hmm. won him lots of plaudits at first.
Seems like a very legalistic approach to the Civil War from a man who was, you know, largely unschooled.
Yes. Well, it was not a view that other people didn't share. As I said, mm-hmm. Lincoln, because Lincoln wanted to keep power in the presidency, said, well, this is not really a legal an activity. But of course, he died before mm-hmm. we got a chance to really see how he would have handled everything. But Johnson felt that he understood the Constitution. I say in the book that he had sort of what I call sort of a cafeteria mm-hmm. style approach to it. The things that he liked were constitutional. The things that he didn't like were unconstitutional, which is obviously not the way to do it. But he saw himself as a champion of the founding documents, and he really cared about that. And he thought that there was a vision that the founders had that he was upholding. So he does resort to legalities, but not in a very, very sophisticated way.
How did he get to be Lincoln's vice president?
Well, exactly how is kind of tricky, because Lincoln never really spelled all of this out. It was important for Lincoln to have someone who he thought from the South, who had some connections to the South, that would send the signal. Lincoln was very good about trying to send signals to the South. You know, it's not necessary for us to be enemies. We can, in fact, work together. So to have someone who was a Southerner on the ticket, he thought was a good thing, even though the South's not participating in all of this, but that they would look at that and say, see, you know, he's not going to be vindictive towards the South. He's willing to take one of our own onto the ticket. And so they sort of ease Hannibal Hamlin out. He'd been of Maine, who didn't give him that, who didn't provide Lincoln with the kind of sort of political, you know, cover, the political cover that he thought was necessary to continue the battle with the South.
And he was vice president for less than 2 months. Yeah. There's really no way of knowing, I guess, how these two people would have cooperated or worked together.
No, you don't really get a sense of it, because they seem to be, and I say in the book, their origins are similar. Both of them were poor boys made good.
Yeah.
But Lincoln went in a different direction. His poverty had a different effect on him, I think, than it did on Johnson. Mm-hmm. So we really don't know how they would have gotten. He defended him after the fiasco of the inauguration when Johnson was drunk. And he said, you know, Andy's, you know, not a drunkard. He'll be fine, essentially. And when other people were saying you should pitch him overboard.
And he was drunk, right? Had to be kind of yanked from the...
Well, he had been ill. His explanation was that he had been ill. And in those days, people drank quite a bit in those days anyway. But for medicinal purposes, he drank a lot of whiskey. And probably because he was ill, it was not the thing to do. And it was a riotous moment, when he's inaugurated. And, of course, Lincoln gives these second inaugural address, which is just fabulous.
Yes.
But Johnson's address before then drew, you know, just howls of protest and lots of ridicule as well.
You also write that there was a theory, or there were theories, incorrect ones, that Andrew Johnson in some way was implicated in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Again, in reporting, talking about doing his life, I have to mention these things that mm-hmm. sometimes may seem off the wall, but there was a longstanding conspiracy story about Johnson perhaps being involved in Lincoln's assassination. It's the old question, who benefits from this? How is it? Because there was a plot to kill not only Lincoln, but the Secretary of State and the Vice President. And Johnson was the only person who escaped unscathed. Mm-hmm. Seward was hurt very, very badly. A couple of his sons were hurt while they tried to protect him. But the guy who was supposed to kill Johnson went and got drunk instead of going to kill him. And people said, hey, what's up with that? I mean, why is he the only one who stands? But there's really nothing to indicate that that's true. It's just the kind of thing, right, as I say in the book, that, you know, when a famous person or dies, or someone who is very, very powerful, it's sort of hard to imagine that that person could have been felled by just an ordinary person, right? So people wanted to make, I think, something bigger of this. And that conspiracy theory continued, you know, right after the assassination, but up through the 19th and 20th century, people write books about it.
Really?
I think Mary Todd Lincoln, I think, who hated Johnson, felt that maybe he had something to do with it. But she was so distraught and so upset by what had happened that that's not really something that we can credit.
And are we talking about, from your perspective, going from the best president we ever had to the worst?
I don't think I've ever made him the worst. I think Buchanan might be that.
Buchanan.
But we're you know, once you get down to those five, it's really it's tough. And it's hard because he had a really, really difficult task, and he just wasn't the person for it.
I mean, the task in part because the president of the United States had been assassinated.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, it's not only it's the end of a war and a long, terrible war, the likes of which no one had ever seen. You know, the numbers of people who died and the sort of physical structural damage and the tear in the Constitution. They had to figure out politically what to do. And then the president gets assassinated after everything is over, this one final thing. It's an unimaginable circumstance. I mean, Kennedy's assassination traumatized the country, but we had not just been through the kind of thing that Americans had gone through with the Civil War. So this is an unimaginable task that he had.
Where did he stand on the Emancipation Proclamation?
Well, again, he realized that it was the politically expedient thing to do, that that's the least that could be done after so many black soldiers had fought for the Union and had given their lives. This would be a measure that would send a signal to blacks, this is where the country was moving towards freedom. And so so many blacks had supported the war effort, that this was something that should be done. And it was, for him, anything, as I can see it, anything that was done positively for blacks at that moment, he was sort of tied to his notions of what they had to do for politics, not because he really, I think, cared about blacks as people.
Didn't he campaign against it, though, the swing round the circle?
Well, the swing around the circle speech was an attempt to rally support for what he wanted. He wanted to build another party, a conservative party that would cut off any kind of further, amelioration or progress for black people. And it turned out to be a disaster because he was a great speaker, but he was somewhat intemperate. And he used language that people didn't think was becoming of a president, of a person who was anyone in high office. And so he was in some ways his own worst enemy in trying to, you know, scope out his new political territory, and he just went too far.
Well, this then gets back to his original idea about secession, and the idea that if the South really, if it was illegal for them to secede, then Reconstruction and putting the country back together then would require, I guess, this control of the presidency versus the control of Congress.
Mm-hmm. And he thought that he should do it alone. He wanted to reconstruct the South on his own. Mm-hmm. And as I said, because they had not, and you just mentioned, because they had not seceded, the only thing to do was to sort of rewind the tape back to where they were, take out the slavery part, which is not a small thing to take out,
isn't.
Right? I mean, that's the crazy part about this. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, rewind the tape, go back to where we were before, put everybody back in place, and just remove slavery, but keep blacks in the sort of abject, you know, bottom position all the time. And I think what really happened to him as he was thinking about how to do this, he realized that the hated grandees, the political, the sort of plantation aristocracy whom he claimed to hate, and he said he wanted to punish, he realized that they were the best people to actually carry out his program. They were the ones who'd been in charge before. So it was a choice between, do I indulge my hatred of this class, or do I use them to keep the status quo? And he chose to use them to keep the status quo. So instead of punishing traitors, he worked to put everybody back in place and to try to hold the line against any kind of further progress. So he said, this is a white man's government, and it will remain a white man's government if I have anything to do with it. That was essentially his plan. So he just didn't have any kind of sense or sort of a vision that the country had, that you couldn't do that, that something had to change. You can't just free 4 million people and leave them with no rights. Mm-hmm. And that's what he wanted to have happen, and that's for the longest time what it was in the South up until the 1960s, essentially.
That was my 2011 conversation with historian Annette Gordon-Reed about her book, Andrew Johnson. And that does it for the President's Day edition of Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edited this show. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks again for joining us.